You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
After the pandemic, there will undoubtedly be a huge opportunity to reflect on how it's impacted and reshaped all of our lives. But for those who really think deeply about cities, the big question is, you know, how cities should be redesigned to better withstand these sorts of shocks. And all around the world, not least here in South Africa, we see a rapidly urbanizing population. So a very important question. And what might this mean for urban design and our spaces that still have all the hallmarks and the legacy of apartheid spatial planning? Well, to find out, I'm joined now by Mokoena Makeka, who's a South African of Lesotho ancestry, raised in Maseru, New York as well. He's an architect, he's an artist, a curator, a global leader. He was named a World Economic Forum Young Global Leader back in 2015. So probably not as young as you were back then, Mokoena, but welcome. And recently a CCID board member as well, which is a huge accolade, the Cape Town Central City Improvement District. So welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a fantastic journey to be here, looking forward to interacting with yourself and the listeners.
Yeah. Where did your love of architecture and urban planning all begin? Who sowed the seed initially in you, Mokoena?
Well, it's actually quite. I'll try and compress a very long story into a few minutes. I always grew up being conscious of space, and what that means is that, you know, from an early childhood, I would, you know, walk into a room and I'd look at the ceiling and see how big it was and how small it was. Loved statues, loved public spaces as a child, but I had no idea that that was architecture. I didn't even really connect the word to my environment, really. And used to draw quite a bit as a child. Used to love drawing transformers. Used to love drawing airplanes. I thought I'd be an electromechanical engineer, actually. And I had a scholarship at UCT to do engineering, but it just didn't match up with my sensibilities. It didn't seem to reconcile the left side of my brain and the right side of my brain. So quite by accident, I found myself studying architecture after a year of engineering. And I never really looked back. I really enjoyed how architecture was really a door into how cities are structured, how bridges work, roads, buildings, urban planning. It's just a fantastic foundation that connects the art of life to life, if you will.
Absolutely.
So that's my journey. So there was no particular person, and I really stumbled upon this arcane profession of space making and city making.
It's an art, maybe described as an arcane profession, but one, as you say, where the art of life is connected with the practical realities of, you know, designing urban spaces, building bridges, and for me, where the political economy of South African life intersects. To my earlier points, we've got these spatial legacies that date back to a history that we're all trying to not forget, overcome, and reclaim in a way as well. When did you begin your pivot to more public work within that context?
Frankly speaking, it started quite early. It was, you know, really in my first year studies. You know, some of our early projects, you know, you design shelters and, you know, small little buildings. And then rapidly as you begin to understand the power of design, you also understand the politics of design. And what I mean by that is how capital is deployed to shape cities, whether that's through private interests or whether it's through state interests. And once you begin to understand that sort of question, which really, honestly, by about 6 months in my first year, I started to understand the cities around me, not just as a physical form, but as an output of the distribution of capital and power relationships. And then understanding that the cities that we occupy and don't happen by accident, but they're actually quite thoughtful, quite well considered and designed and conceived. So if we see inequality in our cities, they are often anticipated outcomes of a particular design process. It's not by accident. And that's when I realized that the one way that I could perhaps make a difference in how citizens experience the city is by engaging with public architecture, or let's call it public design. So whether that's urban design, urban planning, the way we think about our streetscapes, the way we think about architecture, my mission has always been to try and create a better world for everybody without them having to pay for it. that's the difference between public life versus private life. Private life, you pay for, you directly pay for the experiences in public life. It's about what does the state offer as a sort of common basis for all of us to experience life. And so street lighting, sidewalks, you know, public squares, that's the backbone of a society.
Isn't it just, you know, it's those spaces that I think perhaps hold the key to unlocking the potential in South Africa to bring people closer together, because we still live, even here in 2021, 27 years after the dawn of democracy, in our little isolated bubbles. And it's very much, to your earlier point, through a process of specific and conscious design for an intended outcome. So with that in mind, we can design for other outcomes. We can design our cities as places of rejuvenation and renewal, and places where we start to break down the walls and connect with each other as South Africans again, which may sound a little bit idealistic and utopian, but surely that's what we should be striving for if we want to be building a country for all of our children to be proud of. Now, I mean, it obviously makes you an ideal board member for the Cape Town Central City Improvement District. What led you into this particular role? What are you hoping to achieve now in this new role?
Well, I've always admired the work of the CCID because they pay particular attention in terms of how the central city operates and how it creates a sort of standard, if you will, for how we can interact as citizens. And this ranges from issues around safety to issues around, you know, supporting public life and really trying to suggest a different way of being. I mean, I wish that we would have, you know, CCIDs in every single city across the country. I wish its footprint was larger, but there's a direct relationship between its coverage and the amount of resources that it has. Mm. But what does excite me about that is the potential to really be a leader, at least at the national scale, about how we need to rejuvenate our cities, make them inclusive, make them public, and make civic life not only bearable, but something exciting and something that we could look forward to. And I think there's so many things that we can do in terms of that conversation. Issues of, you know, a sort of 9-to-5 city versus what I call a 9-to-9 city or 9-to-10 p.m. city. How do we make our cities safe after work for workers and citizens and people jogging and people living? And how do we increase the hours of operation so that businesses can actually generate more revenue for themselves? How do we think about street lighting, not as light pollution, but as a means to increase the trading hours of the CBD? How do we make some of the beautiful parts of our city, and which are very, have a whole range of amenities? If I think of Greenpoint and that part of the world that is accessible public space, but how do we bring those type of experiences to everybody else within the city? So how do we bring equity in terms of public space making? And I think the CCID really sits at that really important pivotal point between citizens and, to some extent, local government of the state. And it becomes a bridge for dialogue. Our engagement with the police services is important. Our engagement with local businesses is important. And by no means is it a finished product. Let me just state that clearly. The task of making a city equitable and ideal is an ongoing one, and many cities will continue to work at it for hundreds and hundreds of years. So I by no means think that, you know, we are the finished article, but I'm really proud that we are putting steps forward, and the passion of some of the people in the organization is really amazing. You know, we'll get texts and WhatsApps on the weekend about you know cameras here or there working or not working, or what can we do to make a difference, or looking at parking situations in the CBD, or, you know, stopping crime. And, so it's just a privilege to be a part of such a passionate team. And I'm quite keen to see how can we replicate the knowledge. I'm very much a person who's interested in scale. And because if we're going to make a better society by 2030, not only for the SDG, you know, deadlines, but also in terms of our own evolution as a South African society, we have to create scalable models that can improve people's lives. So I'm very much about understanding, you know, what can we do better so that others can do it better than us.
And within that, are we adventurous enough, Mokoena? Because, I mean, with Cape Town in particular, don't touch the mountain and don't ruin anyone's view. And I mean, and it must prove challenging to operate in an environment where, you know, the kind of status quo perpetuates itself. So to come in and propose fresh, bold, new ideas to shake things up, shake the baobab, so to speak, must be tough. What are some of the challenges in getting to this this end state that you envision?
Well, it is very tough, and at the same time, I do want to commend the city for struggling with that toughness. So, having been here for over 20 years now, I definitely remember the sort of post 1994 years up until maybe 96 or even 98 around then, when there was what I call a sort of urban conservatism, the sense that, you know, the CBD needed to be preserved in its current format in order for it to work. We then, over time, managed to show that cities can transform. All of a sudden, coffee culture came in, sidewalk culture, businesses started to open up. We became a very strong creative city, so we began to embrace creativity, not as a negative, you know, sort of aspect, but to say creativity can drive urban renewal. It can, you know, we can think about public art in a different way. So I saw like a huge swing of passion that drove in that sort of direction. Last couple of years, partly driven by, you know, fiscal conservatism, you know, perhaps based on, you know, downgrades, et cetera. You know, capital has been somewhat conservative, I'd say, from 2016 up until now. So we're kind of in another sort of wave where people are being somewhat cautious, and I think COVID has also produced that. But you're right. I've seen so many debates about tall buildings, debates about heritage, debates about public space, debates about where informal trading should or should not happen. And if I look at the arc of Cape Town the last 20 years, I can definitely say that it's been progressive. But there have been moments when you know, we've slowed down, that like we haven't moved as fast as we should on inclusive housing and affordable housing within the CBD. We haven't moved as much in terms of density, and I think which I think is an important part of making cities more vibrant. And we haven't moved as much on a number of things where perhaps an older interest are worried about change and let's call it the aesthetic character of the city as it's framed, not recognizing that all of the amazing cities that we love, and I say we in a broad sense, whether it's Rome, Tokyo, New York, London, they are also cities which are consistently in a radical state of reinvention. And that radical state of reinvention is positive. Obviously, you have the measures to protect certain things, but if you freeze development and if you freeze creativity and if you freeze the status quo, then ultimately the city stagnates. It loses creative capital, so creators move to other cities. It also loses certain types of investment capital. We become more of a what I call a retirement type city rather than a city that's an engine of economic growth. Or what you find is that the periphery becomes more engaged in these sorts of activities. So I think Stellenbosch has grown fantastically well as kind of being seen as a sort of counterpoint to some of those voices in terms of it being a place of opportunity and expression for fintech, et cetera. And these are good things. These are healthy things. And I don't want to pit Stellenbosch and the CBD in any sort of artificial tension. Just to say that, you know, the capital and creativity has a way of moving and flowing, and that both cities, the more receptive they are to positive change and evolution, I think the better for it. And as long as you're just intelligent in terms of how our skyline changes and how we imagine the city, it's great. But hopefully, you know, Cape Town can continue to grow, continue to attract talent, and through the work of the CCID, we can continue to make it a safe place for all Cape Townians, indeed all citizens of the country, to feel welcome. And that does require a little bit of bravura, if you will, and a little bit of, you know, allowing the city to evolve and not seeing ourselves as purist gatekeepers of a particular aesthetic of what a city needs to look like.
Absolutely. Mokoena Makeke, it sounds like that vision and that city future is in safe and brave hands indeed. Principal at Dahlberg Advisors, owner of Makeke Design Lab, recently appointed member of the Cape Town Central City Improvement District. Thanks so much for sharing your insights into what the post-COVID urban landscapes in South Africa and Cape Town in particular might look like. Take care.